Thank you very much, ladies. That's a lot to our Sabbath. If the men would like to take off their coats, certainly feel free to. Maybe I shouldn't have been joking about all of us wearing short-sleeved shirts today that were plaid. That would have been much more comfortable. But it reminds me of the days in Big Sandy when I first went down to college, and we were meeting out in that metal building that was also the feast building, in the weeks before the feast, and asphalt floor and just a big tin building. It was likened to an oven when the sun got hot. I remember sitting there, and they had these fans that were on these big poles going up and down. These were like 3 foot or 4 foot wide fans, and they were there to give you the illusion that the air might be moving, because it never did. And it was, remember how hot it was, and my first and worst day of atonement was spent in that building. And there was a man up there. It was 92 degrees or 98, whatever it was. Two services, morning and afternoon, and the speaker in the afternoon was a fellow named Howard Clark. You might have remembered him. So he gets up with the microphone there. Everybody's been sweating all day. We've walked back to our dorms to rest during the break. And he got a pitcher of ice water. He kept pouring the ice water in and out of this glass or the pitcher in the microphone. And about five people in the audience actually passed out or vomited, it was terrible. So I've never done that. I could. Here's a glass. I don't have any ice or a pitcher. But apologize for the heat. Certainly the school, I'm sure, will get it the system fixed hopefully fairly soon. Give a little water. He was fast of fist and foot and lip too. A heavyweight champion who promised to shock the world, and he did. He floated, he stung, mostly he thrilled, even after the punches had taken their toll on his voice and he could barely speak above a whisper. After all, he was the greatest. Muhammad Ali, formerly known as Cassius Clay, died yesterday at the age of 74. He was hospitalized in the Phoenix area with respiratory problems earlier this week, and his children had flown in from around the country. He had four different wives. It's a sad day for life. I love Muhammad Ali, said his best friend. Ali will never die. That was Don King, a world-famous fight promoter during the 60s and 70s, one who promoted some of Ali's biggest fights. A funeral will be held in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. The city plans a significant memorial service next Saturday. Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher ordered flags lowered to half-staff all across the city. The values of hard work, conviction, and compassion that Muhammad Ali developed while growing up in Louisville helped him become a global icon. As a boxer, he became the greatest, though his most lasting victories may be outside the ring. With the wit as sharp as the punches he used to throw to whoop opponents, Ali dominated sport for two decades before time and Parkinson's disease, triggered by thousands of blows to the head, ravaged his magnificent body and ended his storied career in 1981. He won and defended the heavyweight championship in epic fights in exotic locations, spoke loudly on behalf of blacks, famously refused to be inducted into the Army in the Vietnam War, spent 3 years out of boxing because of that. Despite his illness, he traveled the world to rapturous receptions even after his once bellowing voice was quieted and he was left to communicate with only a wink or a weak smile. Revered by millions worldwide and reviled by millions more, he cut quite a figure, 6'3", 210 pounds in his prime. His motto was to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. He fought in three different decades, finished a record of 56-5 with 37 knockouts, and was the first man to win a heavyweight title three times. He whipped the fearsome Sonny Liston twice and toppled the mighty George Foreman with the rope-a-dope in Zaire, nearly fought to the death with Joe Frazier in the Philippines. Through it all, he was trailed by a colorful entourage who merely added to his growing legend. "Rumble, young man, rumble," his corner man, Boone Brown, would tell him. That's because he had named his fists. One was called Rumble, the left, and the right was called Jungle. But it was much his antics and his mouth outside the ring that transformed him into a household name. "I am the greatest," he would thunder over and over and over after he would win a bout. Few would disagree. He defied the draft at the height of the Vietnam War. He says, "I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong." And he lost 3.5 years of his prime career because of that. He entertained world leaders. When he met Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos, he said, "I saw your wife. You're not as dumb as you look." He also embarked later on a secondary career as a missionary for Islam. But Parkinson's disease robbed him, and gradually he declined, and yesterday he died. He's famous for his one-liners, not just, "I am the greatest," but he said, "It's not bragging if you can back it up." He also said, "It's hard to be humble when you are as great as I am." On golf, he said, "I'm the best. I just haven't played the game yet." I don't know if Mr. Laux would appreciate that or not. On opponents, "If you sign up to fight me, you need speed and endurance, but what you need most is a lot of life insurance." People ask him how quick he was. He said, "Last night I cut the light off in my bedroom, hit the switch, and was in bed before the light was out." By the way, if you haven't seen the movie Ali, where Will Smith portrays Muhammad Ali, it's worth seeing. I'm just telling you that from having grown up in the 60s and 70s and watched all those fights and how they recreated all that. Certainly a lot of people feel it's Will Smith's best performance. But he literally would move his feet so fast, it was a blur. The cameras at the time cannot watch his feet. It's just a blur as he's fighting some of those various boxing matches. When Howard Cosell said, "You're not the same man as you were 10 years ago, he said, "Well, I asked your wife, and she said, you're not the same man you were 10 years ago either." On fighting George Foreman, "I've seen George Foreman shadow boxing, and the shadow won." To Joe Frazier is so ugly when he cries, tears turn around and go down the back of his head. Interesting, he and Joe Frazier were great friends, and after they fought several matches, they would go back and sit in the same room and hug and cry and apologize for their swollen faces and their bloody eyes and noses. When asked how many people who think would like to fight him, he said, "Even if you dream of beating me, you better wake up and apologize." So he has some interesting one-liners, and certainly in his later years, they asked him what he would like to be remembered for. He said, "Well, being a 3-time heavyweight champion of the world, and if there had been a title for smooth talking, I'd have won that too." He said, "I'd like to be remembered as a man who won the heavyweight title 3 times, who was humorous and treated everyone right, as a man who never looked down on those who looked up to him." I like that statement. "And who helped as many people as he could. A man who stood up for his beliefs no matter what. A man who tried to unite all humankind through faith and love. And if that's too much, then I guess I'd settle for being remembered only as a great boxer who became a leader and a champion of people. And I wouldn't mind if folks remember how pretty I was." Kind of an interesting character, certainly for those of us who remember those years and those just the tremendous electricity that one man created all around the world. Other men boxed, but no one garnered a following or created an atmosphere in the boxing world as did Muhammad Ali. And he certainly, we're going to miss him in some ways. Obviously, we've missed him for many years because he has not been able to talk as a result of the tremendous beatings. There are some interesting, for those of you youngsters who can't remember the 60s and the 70s, many of those fights are on YouTube. If you're not a boxing fan, at least you can go and watch his incredibly quick, there's one 10-second blip there where he's against the ropes, and he dodges 24 punches, never gets hit in 10 seconds, 24. And, of course, George Foreman then is worn out, and the rest of the match was a fait accompli. Today, I want to talk about an odd human sin that is laced throughout the Bible. And Muhammad Ali might have been the icon of this sin in our time. The sin is boasting. It's an odd subject, perhaps, but it is not in the Bible. The Bible has a great deal to say about it. It consumes a number of the examples of behavior, not only in the Old Testament, but in the New. And it also is a subject that the Apostle Paul had to discuss several times. We live in a world where celebrities are worshipped. In the Western nations, a bit different than in the Eastern societies. But we still live in a society where today we have an election cycle going on. And all of us, if we have our radio or television on or read any sort of media, the next 10 or 12 months are going to hear a great deal of political boasting, not just on the presidential level, but all the way down to the local level. You can probably think of several examples in the Bible of men who were guilty of perhaps not saying, "I am the greatest," over and over on a ring, but perhaps having the same human tendency. Haman wanted to be exalted. Herod Agrippa said it's a voice of a god. He said, "Yeah, I guess so." And of course, God killed him with worms. Nebuchadnezzar paraded around his fabulous buildings in Babylon and said, "I have created all of these great things." And of course, God struck him down. What do men or women boast about? It is not just a male proclivity. The Bible lists, believe it or not, 8 different reasons why people boast. It's a significant number for the Bible. Let's begin over in Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 4. And I would ask for a show of hands as to how many have boasted about this subject, but most of the men would have to stand up and jump up and down, hold up fingers and both hands, because we men like to do this. And I would have to say that I would have to admit the same thing. The first subject the Bible talks about that men boast about are getting a good bargain. How many men have told their buddies about the great deal they got on the latest car they bought or whatever item they may have bought? And certainly we've all found, you know, good deals or bad deals, whatever it might be. But people like to tell others about the good deals they've gotten. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 14, "It is good for nothing," cries the buyer. So the author here is saying he goes into a shop or an area where there are things being bought and sold, and especially in that part of the world, the buyer tries to downplay the value of what he wants to buy to get the price lower, and the seller wants to upplay it so he can get the price higher. But the buyer said it's good for nothing, it's a worthless whatever, and then he buys it, and when he goes away, he boasts about the low price he got for this thing of higher value. So boasting about bargains is mentioned in the Bible, and certainly people still do that today. One of the most common subjects that people boast about in the Bible is in Proverbs chapter 27, beginning in verse 1. And that is about what they might do tomorrow or what the future might be. This is especially true, I think, in sports, where they will interview coaches or players, especially at the beginning of football or basketball seasons, and they will say, "Oh, we're going to win our entire division. We're going to win the championship. We're going to go win the Super Bowl." At least half of the NFL teams every year must brag about, "We're going to win the Super Bowl this year," before the season starts. And, of course, then the season starts and things aren't quite the same. So Proverbs chapter 27, 1 to 2 says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth." Very important principle for all of us to follow. Do not boast about tomorrow. We don't know what tomorrow may bring forth. Verse 2, "Let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips." So the writer of Proverbs here has an admonishment for all of us who want to follow his words to hesitate. Don't brag about tomorrow. Don't boast about what you are going to do, but wait until whatever you're going to accomplish is done, and then let others notice it and point it out. It's also mentioned in the book of James, chapter 4, because this is one of those that all throughout the Bible, this proclivity of human nature seems to follow this thread. James chapter 4 and verse 13 says, "Come now, you who say tomorrow or today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit." So he's talking about essentially the subject of humility in James chapter 4. God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. But he's saying one way that people are not humble is they talk about tomorrow. "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." So we have a very similar admonishment to what we had in Proverbs chapter 27. So future plans or what you might do later is the second subject Bible talks about, that people sometimes boast about. Now, the third is religion. Let's go back to Romans chapter 2. In their society, the position of being a teacher or a rabbi was much coveted. In the times in which we live, I guess because there have been so many who have either taken to themselves or, you know, started religions of some kind, it's certainly not the same as it was back at that time. But here we have Romans chapter 2. Paul is addressing the Jews of his day, and in their mindset, their society, being the teacher or being the rabbi was the thing of great accomplishment. Romans chapter 2, verse 16, "In the day when God will reveal the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel, indeed you are called a Jew and rest on the law and make your boast in God." He's addressing Jews who were boasting because they thought they had a special relationship with God, and indeed that has not stopped. That hasn't changed. By the way, I've been very surprised to see that there has been almost nothing in the news about the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. That in a couple days, June 6th, will be the 50th anniversary of the time when the people of Israel, the little nation of Israel, I should say, today were besieged by three major nations, all with larger armies than theirs, and in a matter of about 6 days, tripled the size of their land and controlled, took back much of the holy sites of their history, East Jerusalem, Hebron, all the way over to the Dead Sea. They retook Masada, which had been in the hands of the Jordanians. So there may be some things on television, but 50 years ago, beginning day after tomorrow. But reading the prelude to that, it's interesting how the politicians, Levi Eshkol was the prime minister of Israel at the time, essentially communicated cowardice and fear in their speeches to their people. And the people of Israel were getting very worried, thinking the end was coming. It was their rabbis, especially the main one in New York, who called their attention to scriptures like Joshua, you know, be of strong and of good courage, God will give you and give your enemies into your hand. And it was the religious leaders of modern-day Jewry, primarily two in New York and one in Tel Aviv, that encouraged them in these dark days as the build-up to war was very obvious, beginning May 28th when the Sharm el-Sheikh was cut off by the Egyptians, and, of course, the actual beginning then of hostilities. But interesting time to study if you are into that kind of thing. But let's go back to Romans chapter 2 now, verse 18. Paul says, "You make your boast in God and know his will." In other words, they were boasting about, they know what God's will is. How that has not changed. How many people today make their boast in, they know when Christ is going to return, or they know what God's will is somehow. And, excuse me, approve the things that are excellent and being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind and a light to those who are in darkness. So their boasting was that they were a spiritual light to others and a guide to others to follow. An instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. In other words, he's saying you have a form of knowledge and truth, but you really don't have the substance of it. "You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Do you abhor idols? Do you rob temples? You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law?" And Jesus Christ had taught years before that they made the law of God null and void through their own tradition. So Paul is rephrasing that same accusation against them. He says, "For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written." So he's saying that they had tarnished the name of God among the Gentiles, because while they had the form and the law of God, they did not keep it truly from the heart. It's a lesson for all of us today, because we also have the name of God. We have God's law and God's word, and we could be guilty of the same thing, of blaspheming the name of God among the Gentiles if we don't live up to our Christian calling and commitment. Remember what Nathan the prophet told King David when he came to him about the sin with Bathsheba and the killing of Uriah the Hittite? He didn't say, "You've committed murder and adultery." Remember what he said? He said, you have given reason for the enemies of God to blaspheme. Really, he was talking about a much bigger picture. You have embarrassed God because of what you have done. That was a greater sin in God's eyes than just the adultery and the blaspheming and the killing of Uriah. But that's a time for another subject. So religion is something people boast about. It's literally laced all through Paul's teachings. Number four, the fourth reason in the Bible that people boast is their physical strength. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 17. You're very familiar with this. 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 3. Now, this may be the same category, I guess, as Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay before he was Muhammad Ali. Changed his name when he took on the new religion. That he would boast about how strong he was. And even today, it continues. How many of us remember a quarterback named Kaepernick who would get on TV and show off his bicep muscles and point to him and all that kind of thing, and that he was going to be the greatest of the three great quarterbacks of the class of 2013. Remember there was a guy that busted up his knee real bad back in Philadelphia, I think it was. And then we have Kaepernick, and then we had the Seahawks, obviously Russell Wilson, and the one that's left in the NFL is Russell Wilson, although Kaepernick may get another contract. But still, the important thing is that what Goliath said here, relying on his physical strength, has continued to this day. Men still like to brag about their physical strength, comparing themselves to other men. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 3, the Philistines stood on the one side of the mountain, Israel on the other side of the mountain, with the valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath. He was 6 cubits and a span in height. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had armor on his legs and a bronze javelin in his shoulders. He was decked out in all splendor as far as you could do at that point, with all the mail and the various types of shielding and his javelin and his spear. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. Its iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and his shield bearer went before him. So he began to taunt the people of Israel. He stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. So he challenged them based upon his physical strength. And certainly that has continued on down through history. Now, that was number four. Number five, sometimes leaders brag about their conquests. Let's go over to Isaiah chapter 10. Even today, people like to point out their accomplishments. Politicians like to point out their accomplishments, and other politicians like to point out that might not be 100% accurate, and we will hear a lot about that during this coming year. But the fifth reason in the Bible that men boast is conquest. Isaiah chapter 10, here we have the king of Assyria who is bragging about all of these cities that he has conquered. And indeed, he had conquered all of these cities, but it wasn't long after this that God took his life, and he was then able to be replaced by somebody else. Chapter 10 and verse 8, he says, are not my princes altogether kings? You know, even my servants, my princes, my sons are already kings. Is not Calco like Carchemish? Two of the battles he had won or cities he had taken. Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? My hand has found the kingdoms of the idols, whose carved images excelled those of Jerusalem and Samaria. As I have done to Samaria and her idols, shall I not do also to Jerusalem and her idols? And of course, he camped around Jerusalem, and God sent an angel and killed 185,000 of his men. He went back home and was killed by his own sons. But people like to brag about their conquests, and the more they are successful with conquests, the more they want to conquer. Case in point, obviously, is Adolf Hitler, who back in World War II just kept pushing until he got some pushback. with the Sudetenland, with taking Czechoslovakia, with taking lots of Austria, a lot of other places, Poland, and then it just continued until finally he was pushed back. But men are not satisfied with conquering territory any more than they are satisfied with having enough money or silver. The sixth reason that people like to brag, and this continues today also, is people like to brag about being generous. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 25. We all remember that Jesus Christ warned people about how much they would give offerings and announce to others, but Proverbs 25 and verse 14 even mentions many years ago, back in the time of Solomon, that when people give and then they boast about it, they really aren't giving to help the person or the entity they're giving to. They are giving to make themselves look good. They are giving because they want the praise of men. They are giving because they want to be admired. Proverbs 25 and verse 14. Whoever falsely boasts of giving is like clouds and winds without rain. So people sometimes falsely boast about what they've given. Either they give it and they boast about it, which basically makes it a false gift. And he says that's like clouds and wind with no rain. When people wanted rain, wanted to have the blessing of rain, and of course it doesn't come. They see the clouds, but nothing happens. Let's go back also to Matthew chapter 6 and verse 2. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 2, where Christ warned about what happened in his time. Now, we can't really picture this happening, but apparently it did. It would be hard to comprehend people marching into the synagogue or the temple and then sounding a trumpet before they give an offering. It just sounds weird. But maybe we don't do that today, but we might drop hints about how much we've given. Although, thankfully, I really haven't seen much of this ever in God's church. In fact, in most cases, when people give a generous offering, they want it to be anonymous. And if there's been a need in the church and someone wants to give help, in many cases, they'll come up and say, I don't want anyone to know I'm giving this, but please, make it anonymous and, give this to the person that needs it or to the charity, whatever fund. When I put out word this last year that we needed some help with camp because the horses were going to be expensive, somebody from up north sent me more money than I could have imagined they would ever donate to a summer camp. It's actually almost enough to fund it for 2 years, depending on how the expenses go. But basically, with the caveat, you're not to tell anybody who gave this money to you. Not to tell anybody. So I can't tell you who it was that sent me the money for Northwest Camp. And I would want to anyway, because that would be then focusing attention on people, not on the beauty of giving so that 108 campers and 70 staff can enjoy riding horses around the beach. So it's just amazing that people that are converted understand these principles. And it's been a wonderful thing to see over the years in God's church. But here in chapter 6 and verse 2, beginning in verse 1, take heed you don't do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. So even back in Christ's time, as it was back in Solomon's time, people did charitable deeds for the purpose of gaining the praise of men and impressing other people. Therefore, when you sound a charitable deed, or you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets. That would be just bizarre to have somebody come to church and they're playing trumpets, carrying a box as they come in on the holy day saying, I'm giving a great big holy offering. It would never happen in our culture. But apparently it did back then, that they announced how much they were giving into the temple treasury. And there must have been a significant amount of money that Christ was talking about. If you've studied the history of not only the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and how Titus took it after his father Vespasian had become emperor, the records show that was the temple treasury that Titus stole, is the best word, was the largest cache of gold ever amassed in the history of the world. In fact, Titus ordered the temple to not be destroyed. If you haven't read the book, The Roman Siege of Jerusalem, I suggest you do, but have a couple hours because you will not be able to put it down. But Titus ordered that the temple was going to be remade into a temple for Tiberius. Tiberius was a bizarre guy. He was a crazy pervert, and why they would want to make a god out of him, I'll never know. But he'd announced to save the temple because it was going to be used as a temple then for Tiberius. Well, the Jews who were holed up in the temple heard that, and so they set it on fire. But keep in mind, the temple's made of block, and what would have burned would have been some of the beams and the curtains. But it burned enough that it melted some of the gold in the treasury that went down between the stones in the temple. And so when the Roman soldiers went in, they wanted that gold that had oozed down in between the cracks in the stones, and they got out their big iron bars, and they proceeded to tear the temple down to get the gold that had seeped into between the cracks. That's why the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. But even that, the gold that was taken out was the largest cache of gold the history has ever seen, according to historians. In fact, that gold was used to build, among other things, the Colosseum in Rome, which was built 10 years later, using that gold, finished 10 years later, during the time of Diocletian, and it was then a place where Christians were unfortunately put to death, as were thousands and thousands of other people. But so when Christ said here that people blew the trumpet to bring gold into the temple, keep in mind that temple had a huge amount of gold, and this may have been some very large amounts that were given, but they were given because the people wanted to have notoriety and the praise of men. Although he also, on the other hand, you know, we also get the good and the bad. He also talked about the widow who threw in two mites, which was her last bit. And he said she has given far more than those who threw in great amounts. So number six was giving or being generous, a Bible reason for boasting. The seventh may be the most common. That is, people brag about their riches or their wealth or their accomplishments. Let's go to Psalm 49, verse 1. Psalm 49 and verse 1. It's kind of a warning in here. It's interesting that we have this subject warning men not to trust in their riches, not to brag about their riches and their money. But there's something about human nature that when people have a lot of wealth and are known about it, they somehow get treated differently than the average person. It's just the way things are. James warns us not to do that in God's church, that if somebody comes in expensive clothes and obviously more successful in life, he's not to be treated any better than the average person. And those who are poor, in fact, Abraham Lincoln say God must love poor people because he made so many of them. Well, the same has been true in all generations. In fact, the United States of America was the first nation in all history where the poor were actually in a minority. Every nation before this, over half of the people have lived in abject poverty. And going around the world, it is still true in many, many places. Psalm chapter 49 and verse 1. Psalm 49 and verse 1. Hear this, all you peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the earth, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall give understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will disclose my dark saying on the harp. Why should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity at my heels surrounds me? So he's saying there's going to be a dangerous time coming, days of evil. And we certainly are on the cusp of many days of evil. We look at all the trends around the earth today. Those who trust in their wealth and boast in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. No matter how much wealth a person has, they can't save their own life. All the miracles of modern medicine can only extend life a short time, even for people who are extremely wealthy. None of them can redeem his brother. None can be saved from being at a distance or separated from God, and also none can be saved from a deadly disease, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their souls is costly, and it shall cease forever, that he should continue to live eternally and not see the pit. So I think a proverb here, or Psalm 49, is really a prophecy that the cost to redeem someone from being separated from God is going to be far more than any gold or silver could be amassed. But it shall be the cost of the Son of God's life. Verse 10, for he sees wise men die, likewise the fool and the senseless person perish, and they leave their wealth to others. Their inner thought is that their houses will last forever, and their dwelling places to all generations, and they called their lands after their own names. How often this happens? A person amasses a great amount of wealth, or perhaps builds a large company or a corporation. They buy property and leave it to themselves or name it something that will be memorable forever. And yet, nevertheless, they die, and it doesn't remain. A few years later, no one remembers who they are. No one remembers what happened. Their property is cut up in pieces and sold. It simply doesn't last. Normally, when large corporations or successful businesses are passed on to sons who are supposed to run it, what's the average lifespan? It's like 11 years or something. But normally, there's never a third generation. Very rarely do those ever pass on, because normally the first generation doesn't handle like Dad did, and things basically fall apart. So Psalms here, the psalmist is telling us, Psalm of the sons of Korah, so we don't know exactly what his name was, that trusting that they have built a physical future that is going to last is folly. They could buy land, they could call it by their own name, they could call it all sorts of things, they could entrust it to all sorts of responsible people, and it doesn't last. It simply doesn't last. So riches and wealth. Let's also turn over to Daniel chapter 4. I mentioned this earlier, but Daniel chapter 4 and verse 29. We have King Nebuchadnezzar, the first world-ruling leader in the Bible history that we have. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 29. Verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. And the king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a place? Notice he took the credit for himself. I built for a royal dwelling with my power and for my honor and my majesty. While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. Now the interesting thing is, a year earlier, Daniel had warned him what was going to happen. So you would think that he would have said, no, we're not going to do that. I'm not going to boast about my riches and my wealth and all that I've accomplished. But human nature is what it is, and wealth and accomplishments are deceitful as they are. And so King Nebuchadnezzar fell to this prey of human nature. So that was number 7. Number 8, and this I think is strange. The eighth reason in the Bible why people brag is about their sins. They brag about bad things they've done. Let's go over to Psalm 94. Psalm 94 discusses this. People actually sometimes brag about the terrible things they've done. That's obviously going on in our society today with all the social, societal change that's going on. And they tend to tout that in public if they can. Psalm 94, verse 1. O Lord God, to whom vengeance belongs, O God, to whom vengeance belongs, shine forth. So the psalmist is calling upon God to take vengeance. Rise up, O judge of the earth, render punishment to the proud. Lord, how long will the wicked triumph? They utter speech, and they speak insolent things. We certainly have that today almost every time you turn on any news or look at what's going on. All the workers of iniquity boast in themselves. They boast in their works of iniquity. They break in pieces your people, O Lord, and afflict your heritage. They slay the widow and the stranger and murder the fatherless. And they say the Lord does not see, nor does the God of Jacob understand. So they brag about it. They boast about these evil things that they do and they have done. So those are just 8 of the reasons. I think it summarizes most of the Bible examples about why people, not necessarily unlike Muhammad Ali, go around saying, I'm the greatest, or I'm the greatest, trying to get the attention. And certainly the emotional, whatever result of that is, the emotional reward of that. Most people boast to impress others because they want the praise of men. It seems to me it's perhaps a symptom of an otherwise empty life, or an indication of an insecurity in some fashion. Let's go over to John chapter 12, where Jesus Christ addressed the subject. John chapter 12 in verse 43. This may be the pivotal New Testament verse on the subject. He's talking about the people that were essentially the Pharisees, who were in the temple And they were trying to have the prominent seats. They were impressing others with their offerings, with their pontifications, with who could get the largest following or crowd. Verse 42, nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him. It's an interesting undercurrent, sub-theme in the Gospels, was that Zacchaeus, a member of the Sanhedrin, and others believed in Jesus Christ. But, you know, Zacchaeus had to climb up on a stop on a tree to be able to see him because he was short in the crowd. Others came to him at night in hiding because they did not want the other Pharisees to know that they were a follower and believer of Jesus Christ. But it says here that many of the rulers, that would be the Sanhedrin members, believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him. They did not make a public statement that they believed in him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. So they were believers, yes, but they were not courageous believers. They were not willing to risk being put out of the synagogue and losing their position of authority, or losing their position of preeminence, because that would likely have happened to them had they acknowledged they believed what Jesus Christ was teaching. Notice the reason for it is here, they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. So as leaders, as rulers in the temple, they received the praise of men. And that meant more to them than, as John records here, the praise of God. That's a good question. What is the praise of God? The praise of men we have seen is vacuous, temporary, in some cases offensive, certainly not long-lasting. But the praise of God is something we all want and are destined to receive. Let's go over to John chapter 5 and verse 39, where Christ is again speaking to the Jews. John chapter 5, verse 39. He says, "The Father testified himself," or the Father himself, "who has sent me, has testified of me." So the miracles that Christ performed were really a testament from God the Father that this was his Son, that this was really God in the flesh. He says, "You have neither heard his voice at any time nor have seen his form, but you do not have his word abiding in you, because whom he sent, him you don't believe." You don't believe the one that God the Father sent, therefore you don't have his truth abiding in you. You don't have his word. "You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me." And that's absolutely true. They testify of Jesus Christ. "But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life." Maybe he's talking to some of the same men who believed in him but loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. "I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive." So if another comes in his own name, and certainly the Bible lists several of those, one guy named Thutis and another, men who came wanting a following, men who came as, quote, teachers or leaders, and they gained those. Verse 44, "How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God?" It's a very profound statement. How can you believe God when your purpose is to receive honor from one another? It's kind of like apparently these Pharisees were sort of a mutual admiration society, where they were constantly flattering each other or giving each other laudatory comments. It says you can't believe when your goal is to receive honor from one another and you don't seek the honor that comes only from God. That's the honor that Christ said we ought to seek. The honor that comes only from God. Now I want to review before we go and finish that subject to Matthew 23, where he lists some symptoms of the wrong use of religion. Because these men were religious leaders, and their wrong use of religion has continued down to this day. There are many, many churches popping up, many, many organizations. Things have changed drastically, very significantly, in the last 40 years. In the 1960s, there were big churches, large ones, denominations we all recognize, Presbyterian, Methodist, Catholic, Baptist, a few others. There were not all of these small churches that seemed to have popped up like mushrooms in the springtime on every street corner in town. You know, the Highway Church, there's one down here, I think, on, I think it's on the road going out to Battleground, called the Audacious Church. It's strange. And a lot of them are where they are. They're on Chapel Hill. They're on Northside, whatever. They came up with all these crazy names. My opinion, they might not be crazy. They're simply a location or wherever they are. But the interesting thing is how this religious atmosphere in our nation has changed so drastically in the last 40 years. Many want to be religious teachers, obviously. Matthew 23, verse 3, he says, therefore, whatever they tell you to do observe, he's talking about the scribes and Pharisees who sit in Moses' seat, and what they did when they sat in Moses' seat was primarily read the scriptures. They were to exchange times reading the scriptures. So when they sat and read the scriptures, he says, whatever they tell you to do observe, because they were giving the word of God. That observe and do, but don't do according to their works, for they say and do not. They bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But in all their works, they do to be seen by men. In Matthew 23 is Christ's last talk with the Pharisees. He has several last discussions with various groups before he was crucified, various people, most significantly, of course, with his disciples. And we review that on Passover every year. But in his final talk with the Pharisees, he's basically telling them they're doing all these things to be seen by men, and that hypocrisy and the praise of men was their goal, was their purpose in life. They bind heavy burdens. They on their works to be seen by men, they make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. Now, their phylacteries were these little boxes they would wear on their foreheads, and they had leather straps. Now they have leather straps, and in them would be a little scroll of scriptures of some kind. It's interesting, if you read the history of the Six-Day War, it was the rabbi in New York that, when he made his now famous speech trying to encourage the people of Israel to fight and to rely on God to deliver their enemies into their hands, he wore his phylactery, and he said, as a sign of support for the Israelis, he encouraged all the Israeli soldiers and all the Jews around the world to wear their little black box on their forehead. And so to this day, one of the first things that the Jewish soldiers did when they took the Wailing Wall, June 9th, I think it was, 1967, is they all started wearing phylacteries and doing, as they did their little prayers over on the Wailing Wall, and stuck their papers in the wall. But to this, and they built a little booth. It's kind of like a little phone booth with one side missing. I think it's green and black or something. I haven't seen it in several years. But many Americans will, and that's the phylactery booth. You go in there and there's phylactery. You can grab one, put it on your forehead. By the way, I didn't do this. I saw people doing it, so don't, you know, please don't think wrong. But that little phylactery booth that was put there in 1967 by the soldiers who took that part of East Jerusalem is still there. And it's basically called the phylactery booth because that's a way of honoring this American rabbi who gave this speech that many feel was the reason why the Israelis fought so hard and certainly won the war. Now, these go back a long way. The phylacteries they made larger because that would hold a larger piece of paper with more of the laws of God written on it, and that was supposed to impress people. But notice verse 6, they loved the best places in the feasts and the best seats in the synagogues. Now, thankfully, we don't do this today. We don't have seats that are better or higher than others. In fact, I think sometimes the areas that are set aside for the ministers to sit at the feast aren't the best. Down in Bend, it's right below this massive air conditioning funnel that comes down and literally freezes you to death while you're sitting there watching the service. So you'll notice by the end of the feast, that ministerial section is kind of empty. There's people on the fringes and out to the side, and ministers are sitting all over the place because where they have us sit is probably the worst as far as the HVA system goes in that building. And it can go from warm, and then when that comes on, it becomes almost unbearably cold. So I know all the ministers here are nodding their heads. My wife won't sit there, so if I'm there alone, I can sit there, but she will not sit there. She has to go somewhere else. So, but there were best places to sit, places of honor, and they coveted those. And they coveted verse 7, it says, to be hailed as rabbi, teacher, in front of other people in the marketing places. So you see, the praise of men is seductive. The praise of men is addictive, and the praise of men can be deadly. One of my closest friends in the ministry for many, many years was very well liked, a very good speaker, one of the best speakers we ever had, very good teacher. And I sat and talked to him twice and said, you know, you are allowing people to flatter you and praise you. You're getting too many people are saying you're the greatest, you're the only teacher, all other ministers are less than you, and on. I told him, you have to stop it. I said, it's your responsibility. You cannot let flattery be received or given. And he said, oh, I can't stop them. They're going to say that no matter what I say. And eventually, he had to leave and just start his own little group because, in my opinion, my experience, I think he got deceived by the flattery. Now, for those of us who are basically dopes and don't get any flattery, we don't have to worry about it. So don't worry about it too much. But I did notice in a very good friend of mine that over a period of years that the flattery took its toll because the praise of men is very deceitful, and the praise of men can be very deadly. It can cause us essentially to lose out on God's kingdom if it's taken to its fullest extent. Let's go also over to Psalm chapter 52. Psalm chapter 52. This entire psalm warning about boasting, warning about the praise of men and what it can do to us. You know, if you look at the lives of celebrities and how much they are basically a train wreck. Most celebrities, there are a few that have, you know, like Charlton Heston, married to one wife, very, very successful in his family and his personal life. But the personal lives of most celebrities are essentially a disaster. They are a failure. They go through many, many relationships. They might be featured on People Magazine or online.com or some website. But essentially, it's like watching, you know, a horror show or a comedy show, if you even keep up on some of those things, which I don't think most of us do. But I was in I was in Safeway or some store a while back, and my checkout lady seemed like a really nice, pleasant type lady. And I pointed at all these magazines on the counter here. There was, I don't even know the names of all of them. But I said, who buys this stuff? She said, oh, you wouldn't believe it. They're delivered at 10 o'clock every Tuesday morning, and there's a line almost outside the store of people waiting to get this week's National Enquirer and this week's whatever it is. I said, really, you're serious? She said, yeah, I'm serious. They line up. They can't wait to get their update on, I don't know, whoever they're getting their updates on. But what a sad life that they focus on simply being a spectator in somebody else's life. So it's a sad, really it's a sad thing. Years ago, I'll tell you some more stories. It's hot today, so probably stories are necessary to keep everybody awake. So years ago, my wife and I were down in Cabo San Lucas. We went on a cruise, and they stopped at a couple Mexican places. A very nice vacation, by the way. But anyway, we were in Cabo, and when you get off the cruise ship, it's like running the gauntlet. There's about 500 guys there trying to get you to go to these timeshare shows, and they'll offer you a free dinner, and they'll offer you a free tour of the city. And mostly we always tell them no, but this one guy said, well, we'll take you to the very top of the hill up there and get a panoramic view of all Cabo San Lucas. I thought, well, yeah, that's worthwhile. And they offered us a free bottle of something. I wasn't going to drink anyway. So we went up to the top of this hill, and they had this resort up there, and they had, you know, big restaurants, and they've got these rooms that with their swimming pools and all. But their claim to fame was that they built a platform. It was about, maybe about 40 by 40, and there was one of these glass railing fences around it. And from that platform, you could see this exclusive airport just about 2 miles away, a mile and a half away, that was lined with private jets, and it was next to what they say is the most expensive neighborhood in the Western Hemisphere. And what it is above Cabo, there is a celebrities-only neighborhood, and the guide was pointing out, that's Madonna's house, and that's Jose Canseco, and all these famous sports people and famous entertainment people have this housing area that's only theirs, and they have this airport adjacent to it. But their claim to fame was a lot of people joined this timeshare because they wanted to come to this platform with their spotting scopes and their binoculars. And he said they will wait here for days just to watch some star like Madonna walk down the stairs out of her plane and get in a car. And then they can go home and say, I saw her, I saw her. I thought, yuck, what a waste of 4 good days. Wow. But the tour guide said, this is really our, we have people here that crowd this platform if they think somebody famous is going to come in, that they can get, Tom Hanks is coming, and you get your binoculars out, and you can watch him walk 20 or 30 feet. Now, what does that say about our society? That we adore these celebrities who, for the most part, are terrible examples of the way a person should live. And it does say something about the praise of men is deceitful both directions, for those who receive it and for those who give it. Psalm chapter 52 says, why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? We talked about boasting in evil things people did, number 8. Because the goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good. Surely could describe many of our national policymakers today. Lying rather than speaking righteousness. You love all deceitful words, you deceiving tongue. This entire psalm is about boasters. God shall likewise destroy you forever. You shall take away and pluck out of your dwelling place and uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, he is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches. So instead of trusting in God as his strength, this individual trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. So he was proud and boasted of his wealth and his wickedness. Then the psalmist writes, I am like, this is a contemplation of David. It's about Doeg the Edomite, which is a very interesting story. I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. This is when David is running, by the way, from the attack of Absalom. He says, I'm like a green house. I'm trusting in God's mercy. I will praise you forever because you have done it. And in the presence of your saints, I will wait on your name, for it is good. So this entire psalm essentially says that wicked men boast in their riches and in all the other things they've accomplished, but they will come to nothing. But those who put their trust in God will eventually have everything. Now, let's go back to Romans 3. This is a chapter where the Apostle Paul addressed the Jews in Rome who had been known apparently for boasting about their heritage, their possession of the law, their knowledge of the law, and what they felt made them better than the Pharisees, or than the Gentiles in their area. Romans chapter 3, we covered this in Bible study a couple months ago. Let's begin in verse 9. What then are we better than they? It's talking about, are we Jews better than the Gentiles? Which, of course, the Jews would have nodded their head and said, yes, we are. We're the covenant people of God. You know, God chose us. He didn't choose them. He gave us the law. He gave us his rules. We have the heritage going back. He says, not at all, for we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. He's really indicting the Jews here, saying you are just as guilty as the Gentiles. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open womb. Their tongues, they have practiced deceit. And he continues, verse 18, there is no fear of God before their eyes. So the natural state of man in these verses between 10 and 18 essentially is summarized, there is no fear of God naturally in the eyes of people. Verse 19, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped. May be stopped from doing what? May be stopped boasting. May be stopped bragging. May be stopped comparing themselves one another. That all the world may become guilty before God. So we've shown there's all the world is guilty, and there are none who are exempt from that. Verse 27, he summarizes some of his comments. He says, where is boasting then? What place do the Jews have to boast? It is excluded. There is no place for it. By what law of works? No, but by the law of faith. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from the deeds of the law. So the Bible very plainly says that there is no place for boasting in those who want to follow God. There's no place at all for those who want to follow God to boast, either about things they might do, things they might have done. All we can do is simply boast in what God has done for us. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians 11, Paul says the only thing he will boast in was what God had done through him. Now, as an interesting sidelight, Romans 7, Paul discusses at length that he was still a sinner, and that the sin he wanted to put out of his life he found as a law that just kept coming back. And he was struggling with this particular sin in his life that he felt he wasn't quite free of yet. Now, some people have misinterpreted that. Paul did not go out and occasionally commit adultery. He didn't get a knife and go rob people on the highway. He didn't commit any of those blatant sins that some might think he did. If you read between the lines of several of his letters, he says things like, I was, as a young man, more accomplished than all those who were my fellows. He did say, he acknowledged that he had a zealous approach to the law, more than others his age, and had received a lot of recognition by the time he was likely in his late 20s. He may have been the youngest member of the Sanhedrin. Some commentaries believe that. So the conclusion is, it's very likely his sin he was dealing with in Romans 7 may have been either boasting or acknowledging that he had accomplished more than those his age. Who knows what it might have been, but it seems that the subject comes up enough in his writings that it certainly was on his mind and may have been what he was struggling with, or at least why he felt he was struggling with. 2 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 17, what I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were foolishly, in this confidence of boasting. So here he's saying, I shouldn't really be saying this. This is confidence of boasting. But he says, seeing that many boast according to the flesh. Now, they were boasting about what they had accomplished in the flesh and what great teachers they were and how much they felt they were doctors of the law. He says, you put up with those fools gladly since you were wise. But he says, I will say what I have to say. Verse 21, to our shame, I say that we were here too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, so speak, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. And he simply talks about being a Hebrew and an Israelite, seed of Abraham, and the things then in verse 23 that he had suffered, being beaten, stripes above measure, prisons more frequently, being close to death, being stoned, we have record of that in Acts, being shipwrecked, spending a night and day in the deep, perils in waters, perils in his own countrymen, perils of the Gentiles, perils in the city, in the wilderness. These are all things he's saying here now are things to boast about, that God had delivered him from all of these. In weariness and toil and hunger and pain, fastings often, besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. So he that would like to boast, I suppose. Verse 30 says, if I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity or my weaknesses. And essentially he's saying that God had delivered him out of them all. Verse 31, God and the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying, and that he had suffered, gone through all of those things. So it was very clear that any boasting must be essentially giving glory to God and not glory to self. I want to go back over to 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 30. Very important principle. We teach this at summer camp every now and then. A very important principle in this, in the Bible. 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 30 just simply says, those who honor God, God will also honor. See, human nature wants to honor self. Human nature wants to point out, I'm the greatest boxer, I'm the greatest builder, I'm the greatest whatever it is, teacher. One of the early lessons of the Bible, and one that we all must learn, says in verse 30, the last half, but now the Lord says, far be it from me, for those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. God promises to honor those who honor us, who honor him. Jesus Christ said, if you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father in heaven. And so he said the same thing, that if we honor him, he will someday honor us. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1. Someday, if we can live a life honoring God, we will be publicly praised and honored by him. But that seems to be after we are spirit being, after we are part of the family of God, and it will be correctly and righteously taken. I don't think most of us could handle being praised by God at this point in our life. We might jump around saying, I'm the greatest too, with our hands up in the air. I don't think we would, but you know what I mean. Flattery is deceitful both directions, and we don't allow it at summer camp. We should not allow it in our lives. It's too often what we see and hear. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, very plainly, God says our goal is to have praise from God at the resurrection. Nothing wrong with having that as a goal. It says, let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. So all of us are servants of Christ, and we are caretakers of, we are stewards of the mysteries of God. You've had your mind open to understand God's truth, and a very infinitesimal, small amount of mankind has ever had that blessing. You have greater understanding than the prophets of old wanted to see, could desire to see, and you certainly have greater understanding than the vast majority of the entire earth. We are all stewards of the mysteries of God, and we should never lose appreciation for that. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. You are required to be faithful with that knowledge you've been given. With me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by human court. In fact, I don't even judge myself. Paul is talking to the Corinthians there who had a lot of issues with following men, Apollos, Peter, others. He said, I'm not worried about being judged by you, for I know of nothing against myself. I've got a clear conscience. I've done nothing wrong concerning you as a church, he says. Yet I am not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord. That's how I'm going to be justified, because I place myself at the judgment seat of Jesus Christ. Therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes. And I think he's talking about spiritual eternity. Don't judge that a person has missed out on God's kingdom. And perhaps on the other side of the coin, we certainly have good impressions and very positive biblical standards to judge and see fruits in others, fruits of God's Spirit. But the final judgment is Jesus Christ's. He says, verse 5, therefore judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will bring both to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart. Then each one's praise will come from God. We are to seek the praise that comes from God at the resurrection. We're not to seek the praise of men in this life, because that is deadly and poisonous. The praise of God gives life. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3. We don't have time to turn over to Isaiah 66 about that generation that's born in one day and receiving praise from God. But this theme, mentioned a number of times in the Bible, repeated by virtually all the apostles and writers of the New Testament. 1 Peter chapter 1, let's begin in verse 3. 1 Peter 1, beginning in verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope. So we've been put through the process of being begotten, to begin a new life, to be born again at a time in the future. A living hope, a hope of life, not a hope of death, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. So our inheritance is not like the inheritances of men that fade away. Oftentimes people believe they're going to get a certain amount of inheritance when their parents die or their grandparents or whatever, only to find out that somehow it's disappeared or somebody else has taken it and it's gone. The inheritance that we look for is incorruptible. It is undefiled, and it does not fade away. It is reserved in heaven for you. Verse 5, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed at the last time. That reward, that living reward of life, will be revealed in the last time. Now this, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, and life is a testing ground. Life is a time of going through various trials and challenges so that God can test our character, and he will know, just as he told Abraham, now I know that you will not put anything else above me in this life. Verse 7, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire. Notice, the genuineness of your faith is being tested. That's the purpose of this Christian physical life. Gold will perish, but your Christian faith will last forever. May be found, notice this, to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Again, he's saying you will receive praise if you are there in the resurrection. You'll receive honor, and you'll receive the glory, the same that Jesus Christ had in his resurrected state at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So as we see humans boast about all these physical things and things temporary of this life, let's be sure we are not taken in by it. We're not taken in by flattery, the praise of men, or the temptation to boast in any fashion, except about the glory of God, and except holding that hope, as Peter mentioned here, that as our life is tested by fire and various challenges, someday we will be found worthy of real praise and honor and glory at the return of Jesus Christ.